Before the age of antidepressants, psychiatrists relied on a wonder drug. The brand name was Indocibin. It's been off the market for 50-odd years, but now the FDA is thinking of bringing it back. Welcome to the Carlett Psychiatry Podcast, brought to you by the Carlett Psychiatry Report, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psych NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. At the back of the Carlett Report, we now publish brief news flashes to keep you up to date on the changes in psychiatry. New FDA approvals and warnings, research highlights, and practical tips to help your patients, like ways to help them get those expensive medications at an affordable price. This month, we reported on something in the works that could radically change the field of psychiatry, and it's called psilocybin. Many of us know it as magic mushrooms. The FDA has fast-tracked development of this controversial psychedelic as a treatment for depression. And not just treatment-resistant depression, but potentially as a first-line agent as well.
Psilocybin shares some things in common with ketamine. Both can cause dissociation and hallucinations. Both have been classified as drugs of abuse from time to time, or still are. And both are sought after for their reputed spiritual effects. But these two medications are more different than alike. Ketamine and S-ketamine work through the glutamatergic system and possibly the opioid system. Psilocybin is a serotonin 5-HT2A agonist. And why is that important? This 5-HT2A receptor is something we ought to be get to knowing whether we use psilocybin or not. The 5-HT2A receptor seems to have some psychotic properties. And that's probably why psilocybin can induce hallucinations and dissociation. On the other hand, particularly in the last couple years, we're starting to see medications come out that increasingly treat psychosis not by blocking dopamine, but by blocking 5-HT2A. Clozapine does this, as does quetiapine, and to a lesser extent, olanzapine and esenapine safras. But so does pimavanserin, Nuplazid, the antipsychotic that is uniquely approved for Parkinsonian psychosis. And there's a new antipsychotic that's going to be released in the next month or two called lumateperone that also operates primarily by blocking this receptor with little dopaminergic action. Mirtazapine, trazodone, and nafazodone also block this receptor. So far, we have never, to my knowledge, prescribed a 5-HT2A agonist, and that's what psilocybin is. Psilocybin is also natural, where ketamine is synthetic.
So does it really treat depression?
10 years ago, I don't think anybody would have answered yes to that. In 2016, a small study made headlines where they took 12 people with treatment-resistant depression and gave them psilocybin. They saw significant recoveries in those patients, and the recoveries were maintained 3 months later, even though they had only had one single dose. That's the study that got people talking. And since then, there have been 3 small placebo-controlled trials also showing antidepressant effects, with the same model, psilocybin, given in a supportive psychotherapeutic environment where someone acts as a helpful coach to make sure they don't have a bad trip. A meta-analysis of those 3 studies was just published, and they found a large effect size for psilocybin. Important to know, though, that one of those studies was done in people with cancer receiving end-of-life care. In that study, it wasn't depression so much that was treated as it was anxiety about death. Again, they found a significant effect in this small study of 51 patients, and last week, they published a 3 to 4 year follow-up. Again, they weren't taking psilocybin in the meanwhile. They just followed up with them 3 to 4 years later, and the benefits continued. Many of the patients ranked the psilocybin as one of the most personally and spiritually meaningful experiences of their life. And that kind of mystical experience that the medicine created seemed to mediate the beneficial outcomes. So based on all that data, the FDA decided to fast-track the drug as a breakthrough treatment for depression. Last year, they gave it that status for treatment-resistant depression, and last month, they gave it that status for regular depression.
Wait a minute, magic mushrooms could be approved for first-line treatment for depression? How did we get here? And where are all these official organizations such as the FDA, Big Pharma, and other government agencies that used to criticize psychedelics and now on board with it?
Those mainstream organizations are not just on board with it, they're literally on the board. Thomas Insull, the former director of the National Institutes of Mental Health, and Paul Sommergrad, a recent president of the American Psychiatric Association, are both on the board of advisors for one of the pharmaceutical companies that's pursuing this approval. Now, let me just pause and say that at the Carlat Report, we're not really for or against psilocybin. We just don't know enough about it. What we're reporting here is that they are doing larger trials to find out. What we are against is stigma and misconceptions about medications, and nowhere does that seem to be more true than with the psychedelics. To understand that, we got to go back in time to 1957. Albert Hofmann was a Swiss chemist who worked for the pharmaceutical company Sandoz. Sandoz is now known as Novartis, the company that brought us clozapine. At Sandoz, Dr. Hofmann developed two medications that have since gone on a strange journey: LSD, which was released under the brand name Decalin, and psilocybin, which was branded and marketed as indocybin. These were both used fairly commonly by psychiatrists in the 1950s and early 60s, where they were thought to enhance the benefits of psychotherapy.
Oh, these were different times.
Or were they? So back then, these were used to enhance the psychotherapy experience. Now, psilocybin is potentially going to be marketed for depression, but the actual use is almost identical, because as a treatment for depression, it has to be given along with a trained psychotherapist who guides the patient through the mystical state. In other words, to prevent a bad trip.
Why is it used for depression now, but back then for psychotherapy?
Well, back then, things were a lot looser, and pharmaceutical companies were given a lot of leeway with how they marketed their products. In other words, they could almost say whatever they wanted. Now they have to prove that their products are safe and effective for a particular diagnosis, not so much for something general like enhancing psychotherapy.
One dose and you're well for 6 months. It sounds exciting and risky.
And that's kind of what the Sandoz company thought as well. In 1963, this whole business with being loose with the pharmaceutical industry started to catch up to us. Specifically, there was the thalidomide tragedy, where babies were born with deformed limbs because of a drug that had not been tested well. In response, the FDA began to act much like the way it does today, requiring companies to prove that their medications are safe and efficacious. The problem was, there were already 2,000 or 3,000 drugs on the market that hadn't really been tested, so the FDA gave them some time, but ultimately every drug had to prove this. And the Sandoz company was starting to get wind of some of the dissociative and hallucinogenic effects of their LSD and psilocybin, and they were thinking, we're probably not going to cross the safety mark. Further, these drugs were getting into the hands of everyday citizens through diversion, and they had become associated with the counterculture that was rising at the time. The anti-war movement, the hippie movement, the things that all of the official bodies hated. In other words, Sandoz wanted to get these things off their plate, and they literally gave their entire supply of LSD to the National Institutes of Mental Health and stopped producing it along with psilocybin around 1965. That's how it came off the market, voluntarily.
Things went even further in 1970 when Richard Nixon signed the Controlled Substance Act, which created the now familiar Schedule of Controlled Substances, which we use for benzos and stimulants. The 1970 Act also rendered research on psychedelics practically illegal, and it was because of that act, rather than any compelling clinical data, that many of us who grew up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s inherited a kind of stigma toward psychedelics.
Those restrictions on research started to loosen in the 1990s, and in 2006, they started to come off. In the 2000s, a church from Brazil called Unio de Vegetal, which means literally union of the plants, had been using a herbal tea known as ayahuasca to enhance their religious ceremonies. Ayahuasca contains a Schedule 1 psychedelic, dimethyltryptamine, more commonly known as DMT. Earlier in 1993, the court had ruled that Native American tribes, because of their special relationship with the U.S. government, would be allowed to use psychedelics in their religious ceremonies. And in 2006, the Supreme Court opened that up to all religions. 2006 also saw a watershed event on the scientific side for psilocybin. Two controlled studies, in fact, they were the first scientifically controlled studies of psilocybin, showed that the drug actually did produce mystical experiences of a transcendental nature. The studies had been approved by the DEA and FDA, and when they were released, they were applauded by the scientific and even the regulatory community. Herbert Kleber, who had worked under George Bush
Sr.
for his National Council of Drug Abuse, wrote that these findings revealed therapeutic potential of psilocybin that might merit NIH funding.
All of that led to the clinical trials in depression and death anxiety. But it was another governmental act that brought us to where we are today. It was on a summer's day, back in July 9th, 2012, when Congress created another path toward FDA approval, the Breakthrough Therapy Designation. Breakthrough Therapy Designation is given to a drug that treats a serious or life-threatening condition in order to expedite its approval, but usually in circumstances where preliminary clinical evidence shows a substantial improvement on a clinically significant outcome over available therapies. If they are granted this status, the FDA lowers the bar, allowing them through with smaller clinical trials, even allowing shortcuts in the trial design. This fast and furious approval process sounds dangerous. Why are they doing this? It sounds like a bad idea to me.
You are right. It is dangerous. Esketamine, Spravato, was granted breakthrough status in 2016, and it came to market with some controversy about the trial results and the dangers of this medication. We covered that last month. So we're entering a new era. The FDA has gotten increasingly conservative and stricter in its approval process since the 1950s, and this is the first time that it started to loosen up. That means that we can't really think about every drug in the same way, and we didn't know, as providers, if a drug came to market under regular conditions where they have large, double-blind, placebo-controlled, well-designed trials, or under the breakthrough status. Now, I know the risks with the breakthrough status are pretty alarming and pretty clear, but there is a good side to this. It allows some potentially life-saving medications to get to market that never would have gotten through under the regular status. And the reason is money. It just cost billions of dollars to get a medication through under the tight regulations of regular FDA status. Who can afford that? Only big pharmaceutical companies, and even they can barely afford it. So they're only going to do it if they're pretty sure that the drug is going to work. And which drugs are they pretty sure are going to work? The ones that are almost exactly like the ones that are already on the market. That's why we've seen so few psychiatric medications of a truly new nature come to market in the last 20 years. Instead, we're getting what we call Me Too drugs, like citalopram and Lexapro and all of the SSRIs and all of the atypical antipsychotics. These are low-risk drugs. They get to market, they make a huge profit, and they cost a lot to bring to market. But do they really change care for patients? Maybe not. They don't really bring much new to the table in the way that something like esketamine or psilocybin can. The other piece of this is that the FDA plans to do close post-market monitoring of these drugs like esketamine after they are released. We'll see what that means, but what it sounds like is that some drugs that are released on breakthrough status might be pulled from the market later on if it's found that they're not as safe as we anticipated.
So what do we know so far about the dangers of psilocybin?
Dizziness, nausea, vomiting, muscle weakness, sweating, high temperature, and increased heart rate. Those are some of the basic side effects with psilocybin, so it wouldn't be safe for someone with a cardiac disease. But the real fear is hallucinations, and perhaps the potential of this drug, because we know that some drugs like it, can trigger schizophrenia. On the other hand, at least one study found neuroprotective effects with psilocybin. so it's not necessarily toxic to brain cells, although we have to be careful. Sometimes that effect varies with the dose. Low doses can be good, high doses can be toxic, much like we see with lithium. Finally, there's the addictive potential, which is probably not as great as Richard Nixon saw it. A recent review article predicted that if brought to the market, psilocybin would be scheduled as class 4, the same schedule as Xanax, alprazolam, and Ambien, zolpidem. So many of the problems that we grapple with psilocybin are similar to the ones we're still coming to terms with ketamine.
And then there is the psychological effects, which can work as a two-edged sword. On the one hand, psilocybin can diminish fear. On the other, it can induce a paranoid, fearful state. On the one hand, it can create a transcendent spiritual state. And on the other hand, it can cause frightening dissociations.
Whether or not you use psilocybin, and for the time being, none of us are going to be using it, here's a take-home point you can bring to your practice. There's certainly many pathways to treat depression. There's getting more active, getting more connected with other people, physical exercise, getting regular sleep patterns. And there's that one that for many of us is a little harder to understand and grapple with and talk to patients about, spirituality. In the case of psilocybin, it seems that the antidepressant effects are mediated through its ability to create transcendent spiritual experiences. When patients took psilocybin in this research, they felt a greater connectiveness with nature, more flexible and creative thinking. They were more likely to engage in divergent problem solving, where they thought of every possible wild idea to solve a problem, rather than convergent problem solving, where they limited themselves to a more restrained and logical flow of solutions. There's even a study where they were less prone to authoritarian political ideas, which maybe is one of the reasons why Richard Nixon didn't want this stuff around. But you don't need to use psilocybin to get to those places, and in psychological research, studies are pretty clear that when patients go through psychotherapy with more flexible thinking, open-mindedness, and creative thinking, they have much better outcomes for depression. So here's how this research has changed my practice. It used to be that when I gave an antidepressant, I would tell patients the medicine's really not going to work great if you're in bed all day, that you have to get active, doing things, moving around, talking to people if you can, behavioral activation, basically. Now I go one step further. I ask patients to remember a time when they had a spiritual strength, and I broaden that. That can be connection with nature, a creative side, a spiritual experience, or another one that might count is collective experiences, where we engage in group ceremonies that connect us with others. All of these seem to resonate with the type of recovery we were seeing with psilocybin. Most patients are able to think of something, and I encourage them to get back in touch with that side of them as they take the antidepressant and recover. It might be as simple as just fly fishing. It might be going to church more often. And I've found that this is very meaningful to patients. And actually, they're much more likely to engage in it than the other kind of stuff I've been recommending, like aerobic exercise. Well, go figure.
Join us next week for an interview with Andrew Miller on inflammatory biomarkers. If you like what you hear, subscribe online at thecarletreport.com. where you can get $30 off your first year subscription with a promo code PODCAST.
That subscription includes full access to all issues online, CME credits, and an option for self-assessment credits, the ones you can use towards your board certification.